And now on the rundown, we'll turn to a conversation with Scott Keyes of the Center for American Progress. Last week in the Washington Post, Keyes wrote about efforts by conservative states, including Utah, to make divorce more difficult. He joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Mr. Keyes, thanks very much for being on the program today.
My pleasure.
So you had an opinion piece in the Washington Post last week on efforts by conservative states, including Utah, to try to prevent divorce. First off, I thought I'd ask what those efforts actually look like. What are conservative states doing to try and prevent or, you know, put a halt to divorces?
Sure. So these bills come in three main forms. One of the main forms is to lengthen the waiting period that couples need to go through in order to get their divorce finalized. In many states, it's, you know, just it's somewhere on the order of 2 or 3 months, but a number of states are actually starting to extend, not only extend those, but are looking at extending them even further. In Louisiana, they successfully extended it to an entire year that a couple who wants to get divorced now has to wait before getting their divorce finalized. In North Carolina and Minnesota, they're considering legislation that would extend the waiting period to 2 years. So extending the waiting period is one of them. Another is making it mandatory for couples that are getting divorced to take divorce counseling courses, particularly when it's parents who are getting divorced. Generally, those courses are not paid for, even if the divorcing couple is, you know, doesn't have much means to them. It's generally they're the ones who are footed with the bill for it, even though it's being mandated by the state. And then the final form that you'll see this that you'll see states trying to restrict access to divorce is by getting rid of no-fault divorce entirely. No states have succeeded in this yet, but that hasn't stopped state lawmakers from trying repeatedly in states from Oklahoma to Iowa to New Hampshire and elsewhere.
You know, and there's a you in your article you touch a little bit on the history of divorce. Before we start talking about no-fault divorce, maybe I'll ask about how difficult it used to be to get a divorce. In particular, you mentioned, you know, just in the United States, up until not that long ago, the onus was pretty, you know, the bar was pretty high.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I like to point to just in the history of divorce is that in Alabama, for instance, according to their, this is written in their original constitution, the state constitution, and I'm quoting here, "No decree for such divorce shall have effect until the same shall be sanctioned by 2/3 of both houses of the General Assembly." So, in other words, even if you're a wife who has been beaten by your husband, you know, and of course you don't have the right to vote, you would have to go to the state legislature and try to convince the all-male state legislature, try to convince 2/3 of each house that you should be granted a divorce. That's a pretty weighty expectation for anybody. You can understand why divorce was so rare back then. I know in South Carolina, it was. I don't think it was until after the Civil War that any divorce was legalized. The entire state had completely banned divorce until, I believe, the late 1860s.
You know, and then flashing forward several decades, it took until 1969 for California to become the first state to legalize no-fault divorces. Maybe you can talk about what no-fault divorces are, but also you mentioned in your article the kinds of positive effects of that change and I guess more generally of divorce itself, positive effects stemming from the ability to get a divorce.
Sure. So I guess to preface it, you know, in the middle of the 20th century, there were some really onerous hurdles that couples had to go through to get a divorce, even when both partners in the marriage wanted to get that divorce, because what it was is that there needed to be a fault. Somebody needed to be at fault. There needed to be grounds for the divorce.
Right.
And, you know, those could range from someone being convicted of a felony, adultery. One of the things that's often mentioned in state legislatures is that if one partner is impotent, the other partner could be granted a divorce.
Right.
But for couples where that wasn't the case, where it was just irreconcilable differences, they didn't really have an avenue. And so what they were forced to do a lot of times is go through these really kind of creative and onerous methods to essentially fake grounds for divorce in order to convince a judge. So this it could be anything from some couples would even stage a quote-unquote bust where they would hire someone to like a photographer and a private detective to quote unquote catch one of the people in a hotel room with a mistress, and then give that information to the judge, you know, and show them that adultery was taking place, even though, you know, neither partner in the marriage was committing adultery in reality. They had to go through this charade in order to try to satisfy the grounds for divorce. And you know, I think it just illustrates the sham that was the system back in the 1950s and before, that, you know, folks wanted to get divorced, and because the system wouldn't let them get divorced in the way they wanted to, they had to go through these charades. That, you know, the fact that this became so prevalent is largely what led to this system's downfall. Increasingly in the 1960s, both women's groups, who understood how important it was for wives in a marriage to be able to get a divorce when they needed one, you know, whether their husbands were being abusive or, you know, neglectful or whatever the case may be, women's groups joined up with lawyers' groups, who saw how, you know, ridiculous this system was, where they had to go through these false charades in order to convince a judge to grant a divorce.
Right.
Those two groups really teamed up and brought about the end of the old system. And so in 1969, California became the first state to legalize what's known as no-fault divorce, where a couple may get divorced without showing that one person is at fault.
And then many other states followed thereafter. And you mentioned that essentially soon after, the rest of the United States followed.
Yeah, I mean, you know, California was the first state in 1969. The Family Law Act, it was called, signed into law by none other than Governor Ronald Reagan, who had experience with a divorce himself, and so I think probably understood the necessity of having no-fault divorce when it's warranted.
Right.
Within a decade, almost the entire country had joined California. 45 other states had, and by 1985, every state but New York had legalized no-fault divorce. For whatever reason, New York didn't actually finalize their no-fault divorce law until 2010.
In the wake,
go ahead.
So I was going to say, in the wake of those changes to divorce law, we see a lot of ripple effects through society.
Yeah, you know, it's for all intents and purposes, no-fault divorce has been a remarkable success. If you look at there was a 2003 study done by researchers at Stanford University looking at the effects of states that had adopted no-fault divorce. They found that domestic violence was down by a third. The number of husbands who murdered their wives had dropped 10%. The number of women who committed suicide was down as much as 20%. These really important life and death effects that were being enabled because women now, women in particular, now had an escape option when the situation warranted it. You know, I mean, nobody loves divorce. Nobody loves the idea of everybody splitting up, but it's a necessary option in certain marriages, especially when it starts to get into matters of abuse or neglect or what have you.
Sure, safety and other, you know, obviously, yeah, abuse and neglect, as you mentioned. But then, I guess back again to the efforts by conservative states on this issue, there's been movement in some places, and you mentioned Iowa, where they want to essentially get rid of no-fault divorce.
That's right. This is a sort of quiet campaign that's been burgeoning among social conservatives recently to try to get rid of the new no-fault divorce system and, you know, force couples to stay together unless they can show that one of them has been committing adultery or abandonment or one of those faults. This has been going on for a number of years, but it's starting to kind of quietly ramp up. We found, for instance, since 2011, there have been over a dozen states that have introduced bills to make divorce more difficult to obtain, whether it's extending the waiting periods, whether it's mandating that divorce counseling courses be taken by couples that want to separate, or whether it's getting rid of no-fault divorce in general.
Right.
State legislatures have been taking these up. And even just yesterday in Oklahoma, they passed a bill mandating that divorcing couples take mandatory counseling courses before they can be legally separated.
But, I mean, here's an argument from the other side. There are studies that show that children of divorced parents have worse life outcomes. Therefore, divorce is bad.
Yes, and that is the argument that you'll see coming from, you know, not only folks on the right, a lot of researchers. And it's absolutely correct that when studies look at the children of divorced parents and compare them to children of parents who have stayed together, that they have worse life outcomes. You know, we're talking that their educational skills, math and social skills are diminished. They have a higher chance of dropping out of school, poorer health, more likely to get divorced themselves. That is undeniable. The question is, would this situation have been any different had their parents stayed together? I spoke with a sociologist, a professor of sociology at Stanford named Michael Rosenfeld, who, you know, makes a good point that there's no way for us to definitively test whether the children of divorced parents were already more likely to experience those outcomes. You know,
right.
We can compare them to children of parents who stayed together, but that's not exactly comparing apples to apples. We don't know how these people, how these kids would have fared had their parents stayed together. And another historian I spoke with, Stephanie Kuntz, made the argument that, yes, divorce is a difficult thing for kids to go through, but the actual act of divorce is less impactful on children than what, essentially saying what is most critical for these kids and affecting their life outcomes is the high conflict environment that they had been growing up in for the years precipitating the divorce. You know, very few couples get divorced on a whim. It's not as though things are great on Monday and then on Tuesday they decide to get a divorce. Generally, it's precipitated by months and years of fighting and conflict and
animosity
that is difficult for kids. Animosity, exactly, and contributes to them, you know, not faring well in school or having poorer health or on down the line. So, you know, it's not as black and white an issue that, oh, if we just stop letting parents get divorced, then all kids are going to be doing great in school and have better health and better life outcomes, because we don't know how they would fare anyway. And we can't, you know, as much as the government might try, it's going to be impossible for them to pass legislation that stops wives from cheating or husbands from lying. You know, that's just not something that we're capable of doing. And so a lot of state legislatures are trying to pass laws that attack the symptoms of marital strife, but there's no way to get rid of the causes of those. And that's just, you know, two people trying to get along and figure out a relationship together.
Divorce is kind of, in your opinion, the wrong target for these kinds of efforts that may be focusing on relationships or on, well, I don't know, that's maybe not focusing. Actually, I take that back. I'm putting words in your mouth.
Well, you know, I mean, you are, but you're also correct that, you know, most studies have shown that pre-divorce counseling isn't going to push people to stay married. It really only, you know, as Professor Rosenfeld told me, you know, it only, quote, adds a new frustration to already frustrated lives, that, you know, it's a cooling off period isn't really cooling anybody off, in other words. But one thing that has been shown to be effective are actually pre-marriage classes, that giving people who are engaged some sitting them down, you know, whether it's with sociologists or therapists or pastors or whoever the case may be, and just kind of giving them a better sense of how to think about their marriage, how to approach a relationship, how to deal with one another and be, you know, kinder and more charitable and more understanding. Those types of things actually studies have shown tend to be much more successful and important at preparing people for marriage and helping them get through the inevitable tough times,
right,
than it is to go on the back end and trying to stop them from separating once they've already mentally checked out of the relationship.
So, well, then I want to ask you actually about what the motivations are behind states trying to address this from that back, you know, from the sort of end of the problem issue.
Well, so a lot of social conservatives just see marriage as a social good in and of itself, that it's not, it doesn't just lead to more desirable ends, but that it is a really good thing in and of itself, that we should only be passing policies that are going to keep more marriages together, and anything that doesn't keep more marriages together, like the option for no-fault divorce, therefore is to be gotten rid of.
Right.
You'll see the rationale for this ranging from a lot of places. You know, some people cite the Bible, that where God encourages people to get married and bemoans divorce. Some people point to the social aspects of marriage, that it leads to a kind of healthier and wealthier and happier society, that people who are in married couples tend to have higher levels of income, tend to be healthier and live longer, and report that they're actually happier in life. You know, even financial stuff that if you think about it, two households, you know, a divorced couple, it's going to be a lot more expensive for them collectively to maintain two households than it is for them to be married and have one. So,
sure.
You know, you'll see reasons all over the map for why new laws to restrict access to divorce are beneficial. But, you know, they still don't reckon with the fact that there are many situations in which people rightfully, you know, are seeking divorce and probably should be allowed to be separated.
You know, and you also, jumping away from the motives, you also draw a kind of parallel or maybe opposite parallel between this and efforts by conservative states to prevent certain people from getting married, especially, you know, obviously I'm talking about same-sex couples here.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, especially, too, that there are a lot of folks who have been arguing against marriage for, like you mentioned, for same-sex couples, that this has been a battle that's been raging for more than a decade now, but they're only against marriage when it comes to same-sex couples, when for everyone else they actually want to make sure that, you know, that the next battle is essentially trying to keep married couples together.
Go ahead, sorry.
Go ahead.
I was going to say that the spending on both sides. I don't want to editorialize too much, but it's interesting the amount of money that's being spent on one side to try and prevent marriage, and on the other side that's being spent to try and prevent divorce. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, politics can make strange bedfellows. That on the left you have folks who are arguing for more marriage, when, you know, that marriage should be opened up to same-sex partners, but that, you know, arguing against marriage in the sense of allowing access to divorce, you know, which I think many folks on the left would contend that that's actually strengthening marriage by letting people, I guess one way to look at it essentially is that I think folks on the left, for instance, would there are a lot of folks who would argue that even though no-fault divorce would presumably lead to higher rates of divorce, you could argue that it's actually strengthening marriage because it's forcing couples to be more attentive to one another. And if you are a husband who, back in the 1950s, you don't have all, you know, if you know that your wife is essentially incapable of leaving you, then you don't have necessarily as much motivation to be, you know, attentive and caring and concerned with her needs and emotions than you are now in the new system where you know that your wife, for instance, has the option to leave you. You're almost certainly going to be a better husband because, you know, if you don't, then you might find yourself single or divorcee pretty soon.
Right.
And so in that sense, I think you could argue that a lot of marriages are stronger today for the fact that people are able to get out of them because both partners are more invested in it today now that they know this could, you know, this doesn't have to last forever. I actually have to be on good behavior in order for this thing to last. And so I think you'll see more investment that way.
In a sense, divorce is fostering more successful marriages or more successful relationships.
I think you can certainly argue that, and I mean, not just on an interpersonal level, and not just on husbands and wives being more attentive to each other's needs, but I think, you know, you see that borne out in the studies, like I mentioned, for instance, that one of the main reasons why domestic violence, you know, dropped by a third in just 10 years after no-fault divorce is enacted is because husbands know they can't just get away with beating their wives anymore and that their wives have no escape hatch. You know, they know now that wives don't have to stick around and be subjected to that type of abuse. And so I think it's a wonderful thing that because they're now able to escape from abusive husbands, that's leading to husbands being less abusive.
Mm-hmm. Well, Scott, we're kind of over our allotted amount of time here, but I just want to thank you for taking the time to speak with us today on this program.
My pleasure, Roger. Thanks for having me.
Scott Keyes writes for Think Progress at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. We spoke today about his opinion piece in the Washington Post last week. You can find this conversation and all of our past interviews at our website, kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're listening to The Rundown. Stay tuned.